Welcome to the Satellite Evolution Global podcast series, where we explore all things satellite. In this episode, we will take a deep dive into Orbit Fab and its vision for a thriving in-space market for products and services that support both existing space businesses, communications and Earth observation, and new industries like space tourism, manufacturing and mining. Let's get on with it. So, over to you, Crispin and Daniel.
Welcome to the Universe of Bright Minds. I'm your host, Crispin Little-Hales, and today we'll be hearing from Daniel Faber. He's the founder and CEO of Orbit Fab, which is currently leading the way in satellite refueling. The company has made a lot of progress since its inception in 2018, and its future trajectory includes building refineries in space. Now, to me, that is a concept that sounds like it's right out of science fiction, but our guest is going to explain exactly how and why this is indeed a reality. So, without further ado, let's welcome Daniel Faber. Greetings, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Griffin, it's great to be here.
Great. Okay, well, as you know, I am fascinated by the idea of gas stations and fuel depots and refineries in space. But before we delve into all of that, could you fill our listeners in on exactly what prompted you to establish Orbit Fab in the first place?
Gosh, well, Crispin, I can start from the beginning. There was a big bang. fast forward, when I was at university in Sydney, Australia, I was considering what would be a useful thing to do with my life and what would be an interesting career, and realized we'd address a bunch of existential risks if we could get humans off of Earth. So I wrote down a list of industries I thought might pay for the first permanent jobs in space. And since then, I've been chipping away at all things related to asteroid mining. So I built a dozen satellites, then I built a few companies, Orbit Fab's the fourth. When we sold the third one, which had built small thrusters to move satellites around in orbit, I was talking to those customers and friends in the industry about how we would make satellites reusable. And really, the only consumable on satellites is propellant. And what would it be worth if we could get more fuel in orbit? What would be the marginal revenue for one extra kilo of fuel in orbit? It's absolutely shocked. And the answer came back at about $1 million. $1 million per kilo, because the moment they're just throwing the satellites away. So anyway, I called a lot of people and they all gave me that kind of answer. Then I called all the people that I thought should be doing it and said, why aren't you doing it? And they gave me poor excuses, like, you know, their company is owned by other companies that wouldn't let them, or, you know, they're focused on satellite servicing and they need to solve the robotics problem, all these kind of things. So I said, okay, well, I'll do this then, and jumped into it. And that was really the start of Orbit Fab.
So I can see, of course, that having gas stations in space is going to have a positive effect on the space economy, but could you just sort of sketch out what the situation is now and what it could be like if people actually embrace this idea and started, you know, signing up with Orbit Fab right now? How would that change things in terms of the space economy?
I mean, it's going to be a dramatic change. When SpaceX started talking about reusable rockets, people asked, you know, why do you do that? Like, and the analogies of you don't buy a plane and fly it across the Pacific and then throw it away after one flight. But that's what we do with rockets. And people now get that, right? The paradigm has shifted, and it seems ridiculous not to refuel the rockets. And we ask ourselves, why didn't we do that for 40 years? The same thing is now happening with satellites. We're so good at designing satellites with one tank of fuel and throwing them away. But once you've got the option to refuel them and extend their life, you start doing things that have never been thought possible. So right now, every satellite is a tightly integrated system designed to last exactly how long you've got the fuel for it to last for. And everything's optimized around that. There's no flexibility. We put them in orbit. They're never touched. You design them to move as little as possible. And imagine if you had one tank of fuel in your car, you really would regret every time you had to drive it somewhere because you've just shortened the life of the car. That's what happens with satellites. When you remove that paradigm, we start being able to have tow trucks. and in orbit. So it's not just extending the life of satellites, it's being able to do new things. Because you don't want to launch a tow truck and tow a satellite to a new orbit or repair it or something and then have to throw away the tow truck. So we're going to have servicing and repairs and upgrades. And that's going to migrate us to things like a cell phone tower model for telecommunication satellites, where you just need to upgrade the transponders. You don't have to upgrade all the infrastructure. And all of a sudden, things are interacting in orbit. We'll be able to collect the old satellites and recycle them, because you can bring them to a recycling center, which you can't do without a tow truck, which you can't do without fuel. Right? This is going to be layers of things that we've never thought possible. So finally, things will actually interact all the time in orbit in a way they just can't right now.
So, of course, I'm thinking to myself, this massive traffic jam that we have. And when I think about that in terms of satellites, of course, I'm thinking about space debris, the Kessler effect. You know, this is just sort of an awful mounting problem. And I know, because I went to your website, that you guys are thinking about that, because you have a paper on the website that says removing space debris, the cost of that can be decreased by, I think it's 80% with the on-orbit refueling in place. So how did you come to that conclusion? How would all of that work? And is that like the first thing on the agenda, get the highways cleared out?
One of the first applications. So if you think of these satellite servicing vehicles as tow trucks, right, that they can get that debris and remove it. And at the moment, there are some governments that are funding the first few missions to do that, try and remove some of the dangerous debris and prove that the capability is possible. But if you don't have a tank of fuel, you have to launch a new tow truck for every one or two pieces of debris. And that's just incredibly expensive. Like these are not cheap assets to launch and then throw away. So the question we asked ourselves was just what would we be able to do if we could get fuel on orbit? How would we design a network of refueling vehicles and fuel delivery vehicles, fuel depots, and the like, to be able to best refuel those tow trucks so they can go about getting the debris, which is in a whole bunch of different orbits? And the answer we came up with, as you mentioned, was an 80% decrease in that cost, simply because you can reuse those assets. And that's sort of the starting point. It gets better if you look at economies of scale and things we didn't build into that model. The price of fuel is going to come down. The operations are going to get more effective. We're going to find new ways to operate the satellites that just don't that allow them to be easier to be removed. And then we're going to go from, instead of removing them, let's collect them and recycle them and turn them into products in space. Let's create this in-space economy. So this 80% reduction is really just the start of saying, how would we do the thing everybody's mindset is on right now, which is remove the debris? Even that is an 80% saving.
So that begs the question, at least in my mind, who is taking you up on that? Because I think, of course, Astroscale is in that arena. And I think, is the other company ClearSpace? I can't quite remember the names. But are these companies that are already actively looking at debris removal? Are they talking with you now? Is there sort of an uptake on this idea yet?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So Astroscale and ClearSpace have some contracts. There are a lot of other companies that are looking at this as well. And when we started, there were six or seven companies looking at satellite servicing, some of the business models in that, where active debris removal is one of sort of seven different business models. And everybody who's looking at that, who's developing the robotics to be able to grapple onto spacecraft that weren't necessarily prepared to be grappled, then debris removal is one of the things they have the potential of succeeding. The companies you named are definitely among those that are leading right now.
Great. So what do you sort of judge as the timetable for actually having this in action? Do you think we're 2 years away from really grappling with this, or 10 years away? Any sense of how long it might take to get these refueled tow trucks in action?
Yeah, the satellite servicing vehicle, the tow trucks, there are already demonstrations happening in orbit. In fact, Northrop Grumman is already operational in geostationary orbit with a jetpack-like model where they can attach to a satellite and take over the thruster function if the satellite runs out of fuel. So that avoids refueling, but requires that expense of attaching a whole other satellite to their satellite. But still, that's cost-effective. So already we're seeing this happening. The active debris removal, those demonstrations are happening, and we're looking really the economics and the regulations are going to play a big part in how quickly that is adopted. On the refueling side, we're on contract to deliver fuel in orbit next year. So we're already selling gas caps and all the interfaces, getting everything prepared for refueling. We're building the fuel resupply vehicles. But from next year, we'll be delivering fuel to customers.
So I know you've got the rapidly attachable fluid transfer interface, which I think of as ROFD. And that's your fueling port. And I'd love to know how many people are using that, are, you know, incorporating that into their satellite builds. How is that pickup going?
We realized when we started the company that there wasn't a good interface. Like the valves they currently have to fill the satellites with fuel on the ground just aren't able to be used in space for refueling. And we looked at, you know, there were a couple of other things people were starting to develop. We looked at those and they required expensive robot arms and just architectures that we didn't think were amenable to a low-cost refueling operation. So we set out then to design Rafty to allow us to do refueling with no robot arms, direct docking between the satellites, and a way to reduce that cost whilst being reliable in, you know, the vacuum environment with the plasma and radiation and, you know, the impact, the sort of docking dynamics and all those types of things. So we put a fueling port on our first depot a couple of years ago, and that's in space now. We put that through perhaps the most difficult time is when you fuel the satellite on the ground. And so we use our interface for fueling on the ground as well as in space. And you don't want to spray people with some of the propellants that are used. So you've got to be very careful about that. So we went through all that process and then showed that to some of the big government customers and the like. And they got interested and gave us a list of things that they thought we needed to improve that, which we did. And so we completed the development and flight qualification last year and actually got it approved by U.S. Space Force. So now that it can go on some of the national security assets. So last year, since April, May last year, when that was flight qualified, and then July when it was approved by Space Force, we've sold 50 units. So they're going on 50 satellites now that are coming up for launch. And that will give us a great sort of initial customer base to start refueling operations. And a lot of it's been with Space Force as sort of a key partner in that development, helping us by explaining the requirements and why that's so important. Also funding some of the testing and those kinds of things as well. So they've been a key partner in getting this into orbit and a key early customer for fuel.
Great. So I'm going to go back to that as soon as we take a short break. So we're going to be back in a very few minutes. Everybody, stay tuned.
Satellite Evolution Global Podcast Series is sponsored by Proactive International PR, one of the leading global technology and marketing agencies that delivers integrated communications campaigns.
Okay. Hey, we're back with Daniel Faber, and let's talk about national security imperatives. You were mentioning Space Force, and I'd like to know how OrbitFab is going to be able to provide a strategic advantage to the U.S. And its allies, or should I say the free world. How would that take place?
That's very important for us. When we started the company, one of the challenges that we realized was that we needed to invest in these interface technologies and figure out how to do it. And at the end of the day, we'd end up with a gas cap. And if the customers just bought the gas cap and didn't buy fuel for a few years because they're waiting to finish their first tank of fuel, that could leave us a bit gapped on the business model. The fact that Space Force got interested in this, and they've always been willing to put money down up front to develop new capabilities, that's helped us close that business model gap, which has been really useful for the company. But the reason that that's happened is the same reason that Space Force now exists, right? It was stood up 6 or so years ago, about the time that we set up OrbitFab, and that's because space is now a contested environment. It's public that the Chinese have satellites that are chasing American and European, like Western satellites around in orbit. The Russians have been doing the same. And so they know that they can chase our satellites, which have one tank of fuel. And every time we have to move away from them, we have less fuel. And they can keep chasing them until they're out of fuel. And then they're sitting ducks, right? Then they can't stay on station. They can't do their mission. They can't stay coordinated. In fact, they become potentially dangerous debris. So we have to deorbit them, which is a terrible way to lose what is an expensive capability. And so refueling allows you to maneuver without regretting that you're doing it, because you can just refuel later and still have that capability. And so dynamic space operations is a term that Space Force will use about how they want to operate in the future and keep everybody else off balance rather than them keeping us off balance. And that's been absolutely key. So as this geopolitical competition heats up, as space is now it's the ultimate high ground, right? And the US wants to stay ahead of that. Refueling is a really important part, one of the key elements of how we're going to maintain that advantage.
So do you think the current administration is going to see this strategic dominance in space as a key objective? Very hard for me to tell with them right now. So what do you think?
Yeah, then the Trump administration, the first Trump administration, of course, set up Space Force. So I think there's a definitely they look upon Space Force favorably, but also some of the words coming out of the administration now really do recognize the geopolitical competition, the situation that's happening, especially with respect to China, and so that will drive some of the investments that are made. And Pete Hegseth, just this morning, I think it was reported, he was talking about the importance of space as that ultimate high ground, and how, you know, that is one area where the U.S. needs to invest in the staying ahead and in the latest capabilities. So I do think that that this administration will be favorable in terms of increasing capabilities, and therefore at least sustaining, if not increasing, the budgets.
Well, that's music to my ears, and I think that's probably music to the ears of our audience. So, good. So what about space exploration? Because I know we can't get to Mars and beyond without Orbit Fab's vision fully realized. So what plans are underway to facilitate some long space operations? Anything on the drawing board there?
I tie back to our vision. So I mentioned how personally I've been trying to make asteroid mining happening for 25 years because I want to see people living permanently in space. Right? Fundamentally, we need a sufficiently thriving in-space economy to support permanent jobs. That's what's going to lead to settlement of space. And, you know, be it Mars, the moon, or free space. And so our mission is to build the industrial chemical supply chain to serve that, you know, and allow that to happen. It starts with propellant, but we'd love to build the refineries and ingest asteroid and moon mined material and become the biggest chemical processing company in orbit, delivering air, water, 3D printed feedstock, minerals to grow plants, lubricants, like anything that people need for manufacturing and living in space, and of course propellants, operating satellites. So when we look at Mars and the moon and beyond, we see the clear need for propellant. We definitely see that from the launch side, where, you know, SpaceX is planning to launch Starship, but then they need to refuel the Starship in order to get to Mars, and they're expecting to have to launch 20 Starships full of fuel in order to refill one to get enough fuel to go to Mars. The moon is similar. It's not 20. I think it's more like 10, but you still need a lot of launches. Blue Origin, similar kind of thing with their new Glenn vehicle. Everybody's looking at that in-orbit refueling. They're looking at it for those rockets, though, in cryogenic propellants, liquid oxygen and liquid methane, typically, now for these new rockets. We've stayed away from this. We've looked at refueling the satellites, which use storable propellants. Because in space, just like on Earth, the liquid oxygen tends to boil off. And so that doesn't work if you want to have a satellite operating in orbit for, you know, anything more than a few months. And so we've focused on storable propellants, which allows us to build up that capability and experience and you know, logistics network and everything. And then we might look at the cryogenic propellants, but honestly, we expect SpaceX and possibly Blue Origin will look at those as well. So they're complementary technologies that are actually quite different because of the nature of the propellants. But once we're able to process material from the moon and asteroids, we can bring that into the supply chain, and then you don't have to launch 10 times in order to get to the moon, or 20 times in order to get to Mars, with all the coordination that requires. So the logistics of bringing things off Earth are just always going to be expensive. And if we want to expand beyond Earth, we need to start building this logistics, this supply chain, this industrial chemical supply base. And that's Orbit Fab's role in the future of sort of human exploration and eventually settlement beyond Earth.
So it's really, we're going to get to our science fiction refineries in space. That's sort of what it sounds to me needs to happen.
It's Orbit Fab's vision, absolutely.
Okay. So, and you're going to stick with that vision. It isn't just going to be refueling. It isn't just the here and now. You're working actively to keep bridging towards asteroid mining and using the resources on the moon and doing this refining in space so that whatever the fuel is that needs to be refueled, that is needed for refueling, you're going to have a hand in that. Is that kind of the...
Absolutely right. And I'll highlight though, we don't intend to become an asteroid mining or a moon mining company. We want to be downstream to that. We want to be the refineries, we want to be the processing, the storage and delivery. That's what we see as our role in this economy.
Great. So where are you headed in the next, is this, 20 years out, 5 years out, 10 years out? Can you give me a sort of sense of what the timeline is for you, what the trajectory is for you?
A refinery in orbit around Mars might be 20 or 30 years out. And you got to realize we boil this big vision down to today we're a gas cap company. That's really what we're selling is gas caps. So we build that back up. And in 5 years, we expect that Space Force and national security assets will all be refuelable and we'll be providing services there. But in that time frame, we also expect to start to see the transition of the commercial side from disposable satellite platforms to these reusable, like cell phone tower type upgradable systems. So in 10 years, that will dominate the telecommunications industry and probably be our largest market is refueling those towers, those immortal satellite platforms. We'll need to like get out of the way of everybody and the like. But they'll also need to be refueled, so the servicing vehicles to install and remove payloads from them is going to need a lot of fuel. So that's an important part. And realize, once you've got those reusable satellite systems, we sat down with some of the folks looking at the supply chains and C-suite members from some of the mega constellations and said, look, here's what we expect to see in the next 5 years or so in terms of the cost of servicing and refueling. And they came back and said, look, this will drop the cost it takes to upgrade a global constellation by an order of magnitude, and it'll drop the time it takes by a factor of five, at which point communications through space is going to be competitive with anything on Earth, like fiber or what have you, and most of the $2.7 trillion telecoms industry will go through space. So a huge, huge shift. We need millions of cell phone towers in space, just like we have millions on Earth. That's what I expect to see in 10 years' time. And at that point, there's a bustling in-space economy. We'll also start supporting some of the commercial human destinations for tourism and some of the manufacturing things that are being invested in right now. I expect we'll really find commercial legs in 10 years' time and start to expand. So I'm really excited by being able to support some of those business models as well.
God, disruption. I love it. It's just amazing. That's very exciting. Very exciting. Well, we're almost at the end of our time, but any closing thoughts, anything I've not touched upon that you'd like to add?
Gosh, I'm glad that this time right now is incredibly exciting in the space industry, and launch prices are dropping, but the capabilities and the investment is really increasing. Investors now understand the space industry a lot more, and they're looking for the next opportunities. So it's a phenomenal time for people even outside of the space industry to get involved in it, and those in the space industry to look ahead and sort of plant a flag on some of these bold futures we're going to build. If any of your listeners are interested in joining Orbit Fab and our journey, of course, join us. Watch us on LinkedIn, check our website, and we've always got opportunities for people coming up.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, thank you so much for sharing the company's progress and your insights regarding the future. I'm so excited. And I do hope, listeners, that you will take the time to learn more about this fascinating technology by visiting orbitfab.com. Com. So once again, Daniel, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And I know our audience is going to be very, very excited by what
Thank you, Crispin. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay. Take good care. Thanks so much.
That is all for this episode. Until next time, stay connected.